finally reach Killian, a red-hot heat burning down my back. I ball my hands into fists, imagining how satisfying it would be to grind my knuckles into his face. "We're going to have a chat, you and me," I inform him. Killian works his jaw, eyes unsure as he looks up at me. He was a tall guy before one of Leon's bullets hit him in the back and shattered three of his vertebrae. He used to use his size and his build to intimidate everybody around him. He used the fact that he was so much bigger than Silver to hurt her. It must be a real blow to him that he now has to look up to meet the eyes of every single student at Raleigh. "Go fuck yourself, asshole. I don't have anything to say to you," he spits. Maybe he's hoping that there's still some sort of residual respect for him floating around the school. Maybe there is, and the people he trampled all over on a daily basis before he lost the use of his legs are still frightened of him one way or another. I, on the other hand, have never been afraid of him. If he thinks he can cow me with a bit of attitude, he's going to be sorely fucking disappointed. "That's okay, I don't really need you to say anything. You only really need to listen." Quickly, I take hold of the handles at the back of his wheelchair, pushing him away from the locker rooms.
Hey, get the fuck off me, Moretti. You are making a big mistake. Jake's gonna flip his shit when he hears about this."
Huh, poor bastard. I lean down a little as I push him toward the set of double doors by the technology block, heading for the exit. Only he can hear me speak above the chatter and the gossip of our fellow classmates.
"You think Jake gives a fuck about you now, Killian? You think you're any use to him whatsoever now? You're off the football team. You'd be useless in a fight if Jake got himself in trouble. The only purpose you serve to Jacob Weaving these days is that of a distraction. He'd push you into oncoming traffic if he thought it would benefit him somehow. Other than that, I'm willing to put money on the fact that he doesn't even want to fucking know you anymore." Being paralyzed from the waist down would be an awful outcome for anybody. A small part of me wouldn't wish this fate upon my worst enemy. But you know what? Fuck that small part of me. This is exactly what Killian Dupree deserves. Plenty of people watch as I wheel Killian out of the school building, but no one does a thing to stop me. That piece of shit Bronson probably is running like the little bitch that he is to go and find Jacob, but that doesn't matter. What I have to say to Killian won't take long, and even if it did, I am not afraid of Jacob fucking Weaving. Let him fucking come, if he can be bothered. The sky is clear, so pale it's almost white, as I push Killian down the ramp toward the stand of trees behind the tech block. Along a small pathway beyond the line of trees, there's a steep siding that leads to a small gully if you have the stones to scramble down to it. Some of the students like to smoke pot in the little hidden gully, but with so much snowfall over the past few days, it's impossible to even see where the drop-off is, let alone a route to climb down to it. The tires of Cillian's wheelchair are rugged, with a deep tread that bites into the snow with ease. "Nice rig you've got here, Killian.
Folks really hooked you up, huh? This thing must have cost a pretty penny."
"Fuck you, man. Where the hell are you taking me?"
Killian's doing his best to maintain an outward display of dignity, but I can hear the frustration and the embarrassment in his tone, muddled in with a healthy dash of fear. It's smart of him to be afraid. I'd be fucking terrified if I was in his position and the boyfriend of the girl I'd raped was pushing me into a dim, eerie forest where my body might not be found until spring. I don't supply him with an answer to his question. This isn't my first time at the rodeo, after all. I know that fear is an entirely psychological beast. It festers and grows fat on the back of what might be far more than it feeds on what is. The longer Killian's left worrying about what I'm going to do to him, the better. I only have to travel about 50 feet down the small snow-covered pathway that cuts through the trees before we're out of sight from the main building. But I take him an extra 50 just for good measure. And the whole time I'm pushing him, Killian is babbling like a lunatic.
"You don't want to do this, man. I promise you. You're going to regret this big time. My father's going to have you shipped off to fucking Stafford Creek for this. You ever been inside a Supermax prison before, Moretti? They're going to eat you a fucking life. Alex, fuck, come on, man. There's no need to get this crazy over a fucking girl. They're all insane, am I right? You know how they get. They drink too much, hook up, don't want to look like a slut, so they start slinging mud. You know what they're like, man. Look, stop. Stop, stop, okay? Okay. Jesus fucking Christ, all right. It wasn't my idea. It was all Jake's idea. Me and Sam, we didn't even know what he was planning until he brought her up there. Neither of us touched her. Silver Parisi isn't my type anyway. Fuck! I like redheads. I didn't touch her. I come to a halt, grinding my teeth together so hard it feels like they're about to shatter under the strain. Slowly I walk around Killian's chair, and the snow beneath my sneakers creaks. There's real terror in Killian's eyes. He tries to push himself away from me, back the way we came, but the wheels of his chair only sink into the looser snow that I've parked him in. Purposefully slow, my face purposefully blank, I crouch down in front of Killian so that I'm at his level. The guy who hurt my Silver snivels, wiping at his nose with the back of his hand. Still, I don't say anything. All right, man. All right, fine. I did do it. I did touch her. I did fuck her, but you don't understand what it's like, man. Jake's a fucking psychopath. You go against him and it's like signing your own death warrant. This place is no walk in the park. You've got to try and get ahead to be better than everyone else or you end up being walked all over. Without Jake, I'd have been left behind. So, that's it then? Your reasoning? You forced your fingers up inside a girl. You brutally raped her because of social standing? No! No, you're not listening to me. Wait, what? What the hell? Where are you going? I'm guessing there are about 140 feet total between here and the entrance back into Raleigh. It won't be impossible for Killian to make it back inside, but it sure as hell won't be fun. His chair's pretty much useless to him now. He won't be able to wheel himself back along the path without assistance, and I sure as fuck am not going to be giving it to him. I've already started to make my way back toward the building. I pause briefly, turning back to face him. You raped a girl, and yet here you are getting left behind anyway. And from what I hear, you're fully paralyzed from the waist down, huh, Dupree? I'm no doctor, but even I know that means your dick'll never work again. I'd say that's pretty fucking poetic, wouldn't you? Come on, man, please. If you leave me here, I'm gonna fucking freeze to death. Don't be such a defeatist, Killian. What's the point in giving up before you've even tried? There's every chance you'll make it inside before you freeze to death. You're right, though. It is pretty cold. If I were you, I'd get crawling. 11. Alex. My conscience is like an underdeveloped muscle. It rarely gets used, so it's atrophied over the years. It still kicks and twinges every once in a while, though, when I'm pondering something really terrible from my past, or when I'm plotting something truly fucking vile for the future. I feel absolutely nothing as I stalk back into Raleigh today, though, relishing the warmth as I head for statistics. The idea of Killian sitting out in the cold, waiting for someone to come and find him, to rescue him and wheel him inside so he doesn't have to flop to the ground on his belly and worm his way back into school like the fucking snake that he is. I'm crowing with delight over that one. The temperatures are sub-zero outside. The students of Raleigh High aren't stupid enough to go traipsing around out there for the hell of it in this kind of weather, which means the chances of someone stumbling across him are dismally low. He's going to have to weigh his pride against his will to live, and eventually he'll make the decision. He'll crawl, and he'll know for a second what it feels like to be vulnerable, degraded, and humiliated. What I've just done is definitely bending the rules Silver set out. I haven't officially broken them, per se. At least I don't think I have. I personally didn't lay a finger on Killian, so I can't really be blamed for hurting him. Declining to assist someone if they find themselves in a tricky situation? That one's a bit of a gray area. There are two sides to that issue, a heads and a tails on a coin of morality that could potentially fall either way. I don't give a fuck, though. I have zero fucking regrets. It could be argued that the universe has already meted out justice to Killian, taking his ability to walk, preventing him from ever having sex again. but I don't believe in karma or the divine judgment of the universe. My mother believed in God and all the saints of the Catholic Church. She chose to see the hand of divinity in her everyday life, attributing even the smallest coincidences and mishaps as the pleasure or disapproval of her almighty maker. I don't know if God exists. What I do know is this. If we were created by some higher power, and there is some sort of balance to be answered to for our actions, we sure as fuck aren't asked to answer for our sins in this life. Good people die horrific deaths, while the evilest creatures imaginable walk around with the sun on their faces, fortune favoring them at every turn. This life is chaos. Every path, action, decision, and consequence is a crapshoot, and there's no one watching over us, stacking the deck, tweaking our outcomes, guiding the course of our lives one way or another. Call me callous, call me wretched, call me whatever the fuck you want to call me. It doesn't matter. I won't be relying on omnipotent deities, fairies, divine spirits, yin yang, or the ever-expanding universe to teach the bastards who hurt Silver that there will be consequences for what they did to Silver. No, one way or another, I'm gonna take care of this one personally. Statistics passes in a blur. The bell for lunch buzzes and everyone charges for the cafeteria. I'm about to make my own way to the library. Me, in a fucking library, where Silver and I have been meeting up for lunch every day, when my phone buzzes in my pocket. Silver. Music room. 5 minutes? Looks like she's after a change of scenery today. A strange choice of location, though. I change course, going against the flow of bodies that are all heading in the same direction toward the cafeteria, a salmon swimming against the current. It isn't difficult to push my way through. The crowd parts from me like the Red Sea, students hugging the walls, tripping over each other to get out of my way as I beeline for the stairway that leads up to the music rooms. When I was first sentenced to finish out my high school career here at Raleigh, the other kids looked at me like I was a curiosity, a mystery box wrapped up in leather and ink, and they weren't entirely sure what was inside. A couple of people poked and prodded at the box, shaking it to see if they could guess at what it contained. But all of that changed after the shooting. Now people seemed to have decided that I am, in actual fact, Pandora's box, and I should be left well alone at all costs, lest I bring about the end of the fucking world. Again. Fucking, huh. I take the stairs 3 at a time. Having long legs is a blessing. Inside the music room, Silver sits by the window with a guitar on her lap, playing a slow, melancholy tune as she stares out of the glass at the white world beyond. I look at her, and every single thought that was rushing around my head a second ago fades to black. She's bathed in cold winter sun, the profile of her face outlined in brilliant white. From this angle, the light's refracted through the lens of her eye, picking out and illuminating only the faintest hint of blue. Strands of her hair catch at the light, glowing like fine filaments of gold around her head. The sight of her like that, playing so absently, fingers moving up and down the neck of the guitar, telling their sad story. The collar of her plain gray t-shirt hanging loose, exposing her shoulder. God, it makes my chest ache. I'm still getting used to feeling like this about another person. Love has been a stranger to me since I was 6 years old, and now it's swept into my world like a goddamn hurricane, blowing the doors off my sanity and upending everything I thought I ever knew. You planning on just standing there, or are you gonna come play with me? Silver asks softly. So much for her not realizing I'd arrived. I master a stern expression as I enter the music room properly, coming to a halt in front of the instruments, making a show of picking out the perfect one. Silver laughs quietly under her breath, her fingers still plucking at the strings of the guitar she chose for herself. She left her own at home today. With a flourish, I take the oldest, most battered-looking guitar from the wall, brandishing it like a trophy as I pull up a stool opposite Silver. Interesting choice, she observes. I test the strings, correcting their tuning one at a time. When I'm happy that it's ready, I allow myself a tiny smile. Old guitars are the best. The wood's warm. It's done all its shifting and warping. Old guitars like this have absorbed a lot of music. They always carry the sweetest notes. It sounds stupid, but Silver doesn't laugh. She cants her head to one side, her eyes narrowed like she's seeing the instrument for the first time. "Show me," she says. My turn to laugh. "Yes, ma'am. Your wish is my command."
Silver. They say music runs in families, in your blood, but I don't know if that's particularly true. I'm the only musical person in my family. Dad waxes lyrical about playing the drums in a band with his friends in high school, but I've seen the man tap out a rhythm against his desk, and trust me, I think he might have been the reason the band broke up their senior year. Mr. Scott, the music teacher who originally taught me to play when I was a kid, gave me the mechanics of playing a guitar. The bare facts. Hold your fingers here to create this sound. Pluck here to make this sound. Now strum like this to create rhythm. What he didn't give me was the longing in my veins whenever I heard something beautiful being played. That was already inside me. Over the years, I've relied on YouTube to find talented guitarists who made me feel that way when they played. I watched and I studied them, pausing, replaying, my fingers stumbling over the strings, until I finally figured out how they made their instruments sing, and then I made mine sing along. I have never seen someone make a guitar weep in person, the way Alex makes the scuffed, ancient old guitar in his hands weep, though. And the sight is breathtaking. His posture is terrible, back badly bent over the guitar, head turned to one side as he listens intently to the music pouring from his fingertips. Mr. Scott always used to chide me if my back wasn't ramrod straight, my head up, eyes forward instead of down on the strings. It's clear that Alex isn't watching what his hands are doing to ensure he hits the right strings. His finger picking and his fretwork are flawless. He's watching his hands as if he's following along with them on a journey, and the music is painting a picture that he wants to witness as it comes into being. And the music itself? God. Dark, rough, complex and quiet in places, brash and furious in others. The ebb and flow of the melody isn't what I'd call beautiful to the ear. It's more than that. Better. It pulls at me, sinking its claws down deep into my bones, possessing me in a way that only happens once or twice in a lifetime if you're lucky. I forget to breathe as I watch him create his masterpiece. It dawns on me as he closes his eyes, straightening up, tilting his head back, the flow of the music darkening, lowering down into a frenzy of dark, bassy, frenetic notes, that this music is Alex. It describes every part of him so perfectly that I realize he isn't just playing a song for me. He's showing me who he is, sharing himself with me in the most intimate, moving, personal way he knows how. I set my guitar down, propping it up against the wall by the window, planning on closing my eyes so I can focus on nothing but the music. I can't do it, though. Alex has to be seen like this. The tattoos on the backs of his hands shift as his fingers fly up and down the strings. A rose and a wolf, performing in concert. One asking a question and the other answering without skipping a single beat. His dark hair has fallen into his face once again, obscuring his features, but I catch the charcoal outline of his eyelashes against his cheeks, the tiny frown line between his brows, the white flash of his front teeth gouging into his bottom lip. And each individual feature makes my heart surge. He's easily the hottest guy I have ever laid eyes on, no question of that. But like this, with a guitar in his hands, playing like he's been possessed, he is more than just a man. He's a force of nature, a storm trapped inside a glass bottle, raging and desperate to get out, and I can't fucking look away. The music rises, 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 more frantic with every second. Just like the other night in the guest bedroom, he has me by the throat, and it feels like he's squeezing. I press my legs together, my nipples throbbing painfully, unable to sit still. I'm so turned on by what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, that I don't actually think I can stand it for another second. The music ends abruptly, cutting off in a discordant, jangling note. I gasp out loud. It feels as though I've just misstepped, distracted, and I've just walked off the edge of a cliff. I have to firmly press my palms against the tops of my thighs to stop myself from wobbling on the stool. Alex opens his eyes, brushes his hair back with a casual sweep of his hand, and then arches a sardonic, amused eyebrow at me, smiling like the very devil himself.
"What? No standing ovation?" he murmurs.
Fuck, his voice is like gravel, rough and raw, just like the music he just severed from his body. My ears are fucking ringing.
"So damn arrogant, Alessandro Moretti,"
I rebuke. But I'm breathless, my voice uneven and feverish. He can hear the effect he's had on me. He bites back a smile, turning the guitar over in his hands, looking down at it for a second appreciatively before he sets it to one side, leaning it against mine. Next second, he's on his feet and closing the already narrow gap between us. I shiver as he cups my face in his hands, tilting my head back so that I have to look at him. He's a towering masterpiece in a Kings of Leon t-shirt, and holy fuck, do I want to climb him. He breathes deeply and then sighs, angling his own head to one side as he studies my features.
"Well, what do you think? Was it okay?"
He sounds curious now, intrigued, genuinely interested to hear what I thought. What a ridiculous thing to ask. His question is akin to Mozart asking Justin Bieber if he thinks Rondo alla Turca is any fucking good. I'm basically nowhere near qualified to answer.
You know, it was all right.
Alex grins like a fiend.
All right?
Yeah, all right. He nods, still smiling broadly, running his tongue over his teeth.
"You're a harsh critic, Argento. I'll have to do better next time."
If he does any better, he's going to set the fucking world alight. I can't find the words to tell him this, though. His smile fades from his face, a serious look taking the place of his amusement.
"Why are we here, Argento? You haven't been up here since..."
"Since the shooting. Since Alex hurried me inside the sound booth and told me to lock the door behind me. He's right. I haven't been up here since that day. I was scared out of my mind when Jacob, Killian, and Sam held me down and forced themselves on me. But that fear didn't even come close to the fear I felt in that sound booth. I wasn't just afraid for myself then. I was terrified for Alex, so petrified something would happen to him that it felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown behind that insulated, reinforced door. Measuring my words, weighing each one, I explain why I wanted him to meet me here, in a place that now feels haunted by dark memories. I figured it was time to reclaim the space. After everything that happened with Jacob, I used to come and play here during my free periods. It was a sanctuary. I want it to feel that way again. Plus, I'm going to have to start teaching after school again soon, and I won't be able to do a good job if I'm on the brink of a panic attack every time I step foot through the door now, will I? Alex nudges my knee with his leg.
You can take your time, though. No need to rush everything all at once. If you're not comfortable here.
I look around, taking in the sheet music tacked to the corkboard, the scales chalked onto the board, the brass music stands in a regimented line against the opposite wall, and I'm surprised when I reach an unexpected conclusion. Really, I'm okay. Being here hasn't affected me the way I thought it would. I thought we could eat lunch here, since it's too cold for the bleachers. You hungry? The concern on Alex's face transforms into something altogether different. Something mischievous and Machiavellian.
Oh, Silver, you have no idea how hungry I am.
It doesn't take a genius to figure out that he's not hungry for the pastrami sandwich I made for him this morning and packed in my bag. A hot blush creeps up my neck, a shiver of anticipation chasing down my spine. It's criminal that he can make me feel this way with nothing more than 10 little words. In fairness, I was already turned on by the sight and sound of him coaxing that tempest out of the guitar. But still, sounds to me like someone's mind's in the gutter. I'm surprised, I say airily. Alex fastens his bottom lip between his teeth again, pinning his flesh there for a second.
He's biting down hard enough that his lip has turned white. In one casual, possessive move, he reaches out and palms one of my breasts through my t-shirt, growling at the back of his throat. "And why is that?" he muses. "Let me think for a second. Could it be that you wanted me to hurt you the other night, and I haven't touched you since?" I suck in a sharp breath when he jerks my shirt down over my shoulder, the shoulder that bears the bruised wound where his teeth broke my skin. His eyes are hard, appraising, and unreadable as he considers the half-healed mark. I let out another surprised gasp when he yanks my bra strap down, shoving the lacy cup of my bra out of the way, and he frees my breast altogether. My skin burns under his ravenous gaze more than it does against the cold air of the room. "Yes," I admit, "I thought you were mad at me." His dark eyes seem bottomless as they bore into me.
"And why would I be angry with you?"
He pinches and rolls my nipple, squeezing sharply, and a spear of pain jolts between my breasts, firing on a direct path to my clit at the apex of my thighs. Because...
"Because? Tell me, Dulcezza."
I don't know. Fuck, Alex, someone could come in. He pointedly ignores me. It only takes a second for him to pull down my shirt even further, removing the other strap from my shoulder and tugging my bra down all the way, so that both my tits spring free. He fills his hands with me, angrily kneading the swell of my breasts. It hurts, but in the best kind of way, a way I've been craving for a long time now.
"The truth, or you're gonna get punished," Alex warns. "Tell me the truth, and I'll eat your pussy right here and now. I'll make you come so hard you'll need me to fucking carry you out of here."
A low, deep rumble emanates from somewhere deep in his chest.
"If you don't, I'll use your mouth to make myself come. And I won't be gentle. I'll be rough. You won't be able to breathe. I'll fuck your mouth so hard your gag reflex will hate me until we both turn 30.
His voice is soft, almost apologetic. Electricity relays up and down my torso, snapping and firing at the nape of my neck, crackling in the pit of my stomach. The thought of it, the prospect of his hands and my hair holding me in place as he thrusts himself deep down the back of my throat, it makes me so damn nervous, but so fucking turned on at the same time that I almost whimper out loud. And he knows precisely what I'm thinking. Alex places a rough palm against the slope of my neck, sliding it around until he's firmly holding the back of my neck, his fingers pressing firmly, deliciously into my skin.
"Are we going to continue with the charade, Silver? Or are you going to admit it? You want me to use your body for my own pleasure, however I see fit, don't you? Especially if it's just that little bit degrading. Especially if it hurts."
Alex, I'm breathing so fast, I'm beginning to feel a little dizzy. Shame flowers on both my cheeks, bright crimson blooms of embarrassment that make me want to hide my face from him. He has hold of me, his grip like steel, preventing me from turning away.
No, own it. Face it, he commands softly. And when you've done that, tell me why you want that.
Panic snakes its way around my insides, some kind of wall forming a partition in my mind. I don't know why. It's normal, okay? Some people just like it. I wouldn't have thought you'd be narrow-minded about—
Don't deflect. I'll give you anything you want, Silver, always, so long as it's for the right reasons. I'll hurt you until you're screaming and you can't fucking take it anymore, if that's what you really want. My pleasure's rooted in yours. If you're turned on by something, it will drive me fucking crazy too, because it's what you need. But you need to face the why of it, Dulcezza. You want to be hurt. You want to be hurt sexually. And there's a reason for that.
I have no idea what he's talking about. I try to figure out what he could possibly mean, but all I'm met with is that endless, impossibly high, featureless wall inside my head that cannot be scaled. Alex is the one with vine tattoos up his arms and around his throat, but it feels as though there are spiked thorns beneath my skin right now, scratching against one another uncomfortably. Alex, stop, please. Whatever point you're trying to prove, it isn't making any sense.
I just fucking want you. Isn't that enough?
We lock eyes, and I see the conflict in him. He wants to press this, to keep digging at it, worrying at the subject like a broken tooth until I give him the answer he wants to hear. I can't, though. It's impossible for me to give him what he wants. My eyes are pricking so strangely, it's bewildering.
Please, Alex.
I watch his resolve crumble. Okay, fine. It's okay, I'll stop. His hold on the back of my neck loosens. I feel like I'm floating up off the stool toward the ceiling when he lets me go. Both my shirt and my bra have slipped down around my waist now. Alex slowly sinks to his knees, his black t-shirt pulling taut across his chest, as he rocks back onto his heels, taking hold of me by the thighs. His fingers find the button of my jeans, popping it open, and he carefully unzips them, tugging the denim down over my hips.
I thought I was going to be punished.
I try to sound joking, but there is a hint of disappointment in my words that must be obvious to Alex.
God, what the hell is wrong with me?
I'm afraid we're going to have to meet somewhere in the middle on this one, he tells me. I'm all for games, Silver, but they're only fun when both parties are aware that they're playing.
What does that mean?
It means lift your ass right now so I can get these pants off you. I need your pussy on my tongue before I officially lose my shit.
His tone brooks no argument. I obey him without question. As soon as he's ripped my pants and my underwear from my body, he falls between my legs with a fury that makes my head spin. His mouth is so hot, it feels as though he's painting my clit with fire.
Oh my God, Alex, Alex, that feels so fucking good.
It's a miracle I can even get the words out. My synapses are short-circuiting, sending my thoughts scattering in every possible direction. I have to bite back a scream when he forcefully pushes his fingers inside me, nipping at the inside of my thigh with his front teeth.
Quiet, he orders. Make a sound, and I'll stop. Is that what you want?
I almost make the mistake of answering him. He narrows his eyes, giving me a warning glance up the length of my body, and I manage to stop myself just in time.
Well, he asks.
I see that his lips are wet from the slick heat between my legs, and I have to try doubly hard not to cry out. Instead, I nod, letting him know that I'll obey his rules, even if it kills me.
Good.
He drives his tongue back between the folds of my pussy, flicking and laving, grinding the flat of his tongue into me so hard that I find myself bucking and rocking against his mouth. Just as he did with the guitar, he uses his hands to conduct a symphony, except this time, my body is his instrument. Using both his index and his middle finger, he fucks my pussy, pumping them quickly inside me, harder than he has before, and my body feels as though it's coming alive. I'm balancing so precariously on the stool that I'm probably going to fall off any second. I have to cling to the smooth wooden seat beneath my ass to prevent myself from tumbling to the floor.
Fuck, your tits look amazing when they bounce like that,
Alex snarls. He takes my left breast in his free hand, clasping hold of my nipple between his thumb and his index finger, and he rolls the swollen knot of flesh so hard that I can't help it.
Ah, Alex!
The cry is out before I can pull it back. Alex growls, baring his teeth, withdrawing his fingers from inside me.
Disobedient,
he accuses.
Please, please, God, Alex, I need to come, please.
You're making it worse.
I bite down on the inside of my lip. I will not speak. I will not moan. I will not make a sound. Alex waits a second, his eyes running me through, stretching out the moment, torturing me just a second longer. But then he flicks at my clitoris with the tip of his tongue, thrusting his fingers back inside me, and my head lights up with fireworks. This time when he pinches my nipple, savage enough to make me want to pull away from the burning agony of the pain, I don't make a single fucking sound. Alex sucks at my pussy, massaging my clit with his tongue at the same time, and my head rips back, hanging loose between my shoulders. For all intents and purposes, I'm naked. My tits are bare, my legs are spread as wide as they can go, my pussy exposed to anyone who might walk into the music room. But I don't care. All that matters are Alex's teeth applying a dizzying pressure to my clit, promising more pain, and his fingers, which are now slamming into me so hard that I can hardly breathe around the sensation. I chant to myself, the words searing the back of my throat. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Please, let me come. Alex, let me come. Down to the last muscle, my body tenses. I'm a quivering wreck as I hover on the brink of annihilation, waiting for it to claim me. The crushing sensation builds and builds, ready to crash over me any second. Alex reads my body as easily as an open book. He rumbles, curling his fingers inside me, beckoning me toward my climax. And that one small movement sends me hurtling over the edge. My body takes over, my thighs clamping hard around Alex's head. His teeth find the sweet, sensitive spot just to the inside of my thigh again, and I can't take it anymore. I let the tumbling, falling madness take me, riding it out blindly, my eyes rolling back into my skull.
That's it. Good girl. Show me. Show me how much you need it, Alex hisses.
I convulse against him, everything suddenly much, too sensitive, the feeling of his fingers inside me, his thumb against my clit, enough to make me squirm off the damn stool. Shit, stop, 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 I can't.
Can't handle how good it feels 1 second longer.
You see, Alex knows this as well as I do. Pain and pleasure are interchangeable. What should cause us to cry out in agony sometimes evokes ecstasy. And the afterburn of an orgasm can sometimes feel so intense that tolerating it for 1 moment longer becomes physically impossible. Alex laughs darkly as he withdraws his fingers, enjoying the way I shake and shiver just a little too much.
It's like watching a star explode when you come, Argento.
I'm too slack-limbed and dazed to ask him whether that's a good or a bad thing. Getting to his feet, he draws me to him, letting my head rest against his stomach for a second while I catch my breath. I feel like a cat, deliriously content and satisfied as he gently pets me, running his hands over my hair, whispering things to me in Italian.
Shh. Respire, cuore mio. Rilassare. Tutto a posto. Sono qui. Mi prenderò cura di te.
I persuade myself not to ask him what he's saying. His voice is hushed, little more than a whisper. I get the feeling the soft susurrus of his words are for himself and himself alone. The silence is shattered a split second later by the blaring shriek of the bell. Both of us nearly jump out of our skin. Fuck. Alex snatches up my jeans and thrusts them at me in a hurry.
Quick, Argento. We need to get the fuck out of here. Immediately.
I'm laughing, my heart beating out of my chest, as I pull my clothes back on, hands fumbling over my bra straps, my heels getting caught inside legs of my pants. A clamor of voices and footsteps echo up to us through the open door to the music room, signaling that not one, but a number of people are racing up the stairs towards us. I've just jammed my right foot back into my Converse when Sophie Maines comes flying through the doorway, her eyes as big as saucers. 3 other freshmen bustle in behind her, all young girls I don't know.
What the fuck are you doing in here? Haven't you guys heard?
Sophie pants, slapping her palm against her chest.
There's all kinds of crazy shit going on outside Darhauer's office. Killian Dupree was found half frozen down by the gully. They think he's been out there for hours.
Killian Dupree's name is like a slap to the face. I recoil from it, physically taking a step back, the stool behind me tipping, until Alex catches it up and sets it back on its feet. A low, mournful siren wails in the distance, growing louder and louder. All 6 of us stand in front of the bank of windows in the music room, watching the small, white block-shaped vehicle racing up the winding hill toward Raleigh. An ambulance.
Poor Killian, Sophie says. First he gets shot by that lunatic and ends up in a wheelchair, then he winds up falling out of it in the snow and suffering from exposure. It just doesn't seem right.
Seems perfectly right to me,
Alex counters under his breath. I dart a sideways look at him, ears burning, feeling... What the hell am I feeling?
Alex,
I hiss through my teeth. He doesn't answer me, doesn't even look away from the window. The line of his jaw is hard, a muscle ticking in his neck.
Come on, we'd better get to class, he says stiffly.
The ambulance finally pulls into the parking lot. Karen Gilchrist, Principal Darhauer's assistant, totters out across the slushy snow in her high heels, hands fluttering everywhere as she gesticulates wildly back inside the school, calling out to the EMTs. Alex gives the scene below one last bored, uninterested glance, then takes me by the hand and pulls me away from the window. The halls are empty as we head toward physics, and our footfall echoes off the walls. I'm too disturbed by the mental image of Killian being lifted onto a gurney to even really notice the sound. The beautiful boy with the black hair and the intricate ink leading me down the hall, away from the fray at the entrance of the school, begins to hum a jaunty, body kind of song that makes you want to tap your foot. Sounds like an old pirate reel. I pull at his hand. Alex, Alessandro Moretti, tell me you had nothing to do with this. He looks down at me over his shoulder, a wry smile tugging up one side of his mouth, utterly remorseless. As a proud citizen of this fine country, Dolcezza, in this particular instance, it is my right and privilege to exercise the fifth.
12. Alex. The rock is wall-to-wall bodies when I walk through the front door. The walls are running with condensation from all the body heat, sweat, and evaporating snow the crowd have trekked in on their winter boots. It's always like this after bad weather. Trapped inside for days, the locals go a little stir-crazy, holed up in their own houses. So the moment the road's clear and the snow plows have finished their work, people converge on the bar en masse. I would have entered in through the back of the building, but the parking lot was a fucking nightmare and I couldn't even get to the entrance.
Alex, hey baby boy, come to join the party?
Stella, one of Monty's favorite dancers, shouts at me from the stage. She's completely naked, but I'm a fucking pro at this game. I perfected the art of maintaining eye contact with the girls a long, long time ago.
Come on, baby, pull up a pew. I'll give you a dance, my treat.
She gives me a wriggle of her shoulders, making her tits bounce for me. And the group of punters seated at her feet all groan and grouse. They've probably been sitting there for the last 15 minutes, dropping dollar bills at her stilettoed feet, and now she's offering a free dance to some punk kid who just showed up out of the cold? Yeah, that's enough to make any man gripe. Next time, Stell, gotta find the boss man. I shout back at her. There won't be a next time, of course. I've never fucked with the girls here. Why? First and foremost, I'm not fucking stupid. If I caused drama within the walls of the rock, Monty would have my fucking hide. Secondly, fake tits gross me out. However, both of those points are academic now because I'm with Silver, and all other women are dead to me. Stella's really sweet. She's one of the younger dancers, a freshman in college. My old friends at Bellingham would have gnawed off their own right arms for a chance at fucking her. But my skin feels like it's crawling as I shove my way through the heaving press of bodies on the bar floor, heading for the door by the bathrooms that reads, Employees Only. Polly, the bartender, has rushed off his feet, hands flying everywhere, pouring numerous drinks at once, knocking a flowing beer tap off with his elbow. He notices me and shouts a hello as I disappear through the door. Takes a moment for my eyes to adjust to the darkness in the hallway. I step over stacks of empty boxes and narrowly miss kicking over a row of empty Jack Daniels bottles as I negotiate my way down the corridor toward Monty's office. When I turn the corner, weirdly pumped, adrenaline surging through my veins, I catch the old man standing outside the doorway to his private sanctuary, pinning a guy up against the wall by his fucking throat. The guy, some piece of shit in a leather jacket with a buzz cut, pats down his pockets, searching for something. A gun? A knife? Monty doesn't seem perturbed by the potential that he might be about to get shot or shanked. He stabs a finger into the guy's face, flecks of spittle flying as he snarls. I didn't ask you to tell me where he isn't. I told you to bring him here. Instead, you're sitting at the bar drinking off my promo tab, trying to get your dick sucked. Did I not tell you this was urgent? The punk gurgles. I can't tell if he's trying to say something or simply trying to breathe. Finally managing to stick his hand into his pocket, he goes to pull something out and I decide I've seen enough. I drop the duffel bag I've been carrying to the floor and charge down the hallway, a threatening growl on my lips.
Monty never gets angry. For him to be this openly pissed off, this neo-Nazi-looking asshole must have really fucked up, and I'm not about to let my boss get stabbed by him. My fists raised, body prepped for a fight, when two things happen. The punk pulls out a tattered, worn piece of paper from his pocket, and Monty sees my barreling approach. He holds up a hand, calling me off before I even reach them. Calm, son. No need for any of that. Jonas was just explaining something to me, weren't you, Joe? Go on in and make yourself comfortable, Alex. I'll be with you in a second. I'd argue, offer to stay, but then I make eye contact with Jonas and see that the guy's absolutely shitting himself. He might look like a hardened thug, but he won't be causing any trouble for Monty, that's for sure. I go and grab the bag I just dropped, giving the old man a tight smile as I head into his office. Monty boots the door closed behind me, but I can still hear his furious words. An address? What the fuck is wrong with you? I thought you'd want to pay him a visit yourself, boss. For fuck's sake, there's a reason why you're not on Q's payroll yet, Jonas. You can't follow simple directions. I didn't ask you to think. I made it real fucking simple for you. Bring him here means exactly that, motherfucker. Why the fuck would I want to drive all the way to Vancouver and drag the piece of shit across border lines myself? I'm sorry, man. I'll go now. I can be back here with him by morning. Monty curses colorfully. You fuck this up and Q's gonna relegate you to prospect quicker than you can say shit, kicker. Get the fuck out of my sight, boy, before I demote you myself. Ah. Club business, then, not bar business. I forget Monty's even affiliated with an MC most days. He's diligent about keeping those two parts of his life separate. Church and state, he calls it. Church being his club, state being the rock. He's always preferred the two organizations never cross over unless it's for pleasure, but seems as though there was no helping it today. When he barges into the office, slamming the door closed behind him, the old man's so angry he looks like he's going to burst a blood vessel. Fucking moron. I swear that son of a bitch was dropped on his head repeatedly when he was a child. He collapses into his chair with an oomph, setting his hands down on the black bag that I've placed on his desk for him. I needed this 3 nights ago. Badly, he tells me. Sorry, man. You asked me to keep hold of it. Then the snow... I know. You're not to blame. He pinches at the bridge of his nose, sighing heavily. Just been one of those weeks. Don't suppose you took a peek inside. His voice is weary, but he's added a dash of playfulness to his tone. Unlike Jonas, I am not a dumb motherfucker. Nope, the contents of that bag are none of my business. Monty nods, smiling from ear to ear. Good, glad to hear it. And then he unzips the bag, opening it up right in front of me. My eyes hit the ceiling. My midnight runs for Monty have been a science experiment of sorts, paradoxical. A demonstration of the legitimacy of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. Schrödinger explained the experiment best with his cat analogy. But in this circumstance, there is no box and there is no cat. There have been bags, and there have been theoretical drugs. Without looking inside any of the bags I have been running for Monty, the drugs have both existed and not existed at the same time. Once I look inside, the contents of the bags will manifest themselves into being, and there will be no denying their existence one way or another. What I'm trying to say, in a roundabout way, is that ignorance is fucking bliss. If I see bricks of coke in that bag right now, I become complicit in something that, up until this very moment, I would be able to deny. I quit being such a little bitch, Monty mutters under his breath. Here, hold this. He offers something out to me. I look down. And it's too late. I've just been handed a fucking gun. A mean-looking silver thing, big enough to blow someone's fucking head off. I've never held a gun this big before. Desert Eagle, Monty informs me, leaning forward across his desk, steepling his fingers. He's frowning at the weapon like it's a rearing cobra and it's about to strike at him any second. Heavy, huh? Hard to come by, Desert Eagles, Not really the kind of gun you want to be carrying around stuffed in the back of your waistband. Too ostentatious. Conspicuous, you could say. I lay the gun down on his desk, muzzle pointing away toward the door. Guns aren't really my thing. Me either, Monty agrees. A necessary evil sometimes, though. You disposed of the one I gave you the other night like I asked? Wait, never mind. That doesn't matter right now. This bag belongs to an enforcer in Seattle, some hotshot who likes to carry the tools of his trade around with him wherever he goes. I hear he's pretty good at torturing people. Jesus Christ, would you look at this? Monty's eyebrows nearly hit his hairline, which is impressive given the fact that he's receding. In his hand, a weird metal contraption with handles that look like a caliper or some sort of vice. The ends of it are sharp, wickedly sharp. The kind of damage you can inflict upon a person with something like that. At least it's not fucking drugs. There are other items and implements visible through the opening of the bag. Handcuffs, scalpels, brass knuckles, small boxes containing God knows what. A huge hunting knife and a sheath. Aside from the gun, none of it is illegal, though. I can't help myself. And this shit's so important to you because... Monty smirks, zipping up the bag and dumping it on the floor at his feet. Collateral. There are people chasing this guy all over Seattle right now. Something in this bag is worth big money, and they want it bad. The bag's mine now, which means whatever they want inside it is mine too. I'll be presiding over a bidding war on Blacknet by the end of the day. You need to be into some dark shit to even score an account on Blacknet. Not just drugs or guns. Gangs and criminal entities trade in flesh on that site every day of the week. I've heard you only need 15 grand in your back pocket if you're looking to hire someone to commit murder on your behalf. Monty's always been hungry for power and money, just like Westbrook said. But fucking around on a site like the Black Net? That's kind of surprising, even for him. It's not my place to judge, definitely not my place to get involved. I'm giving this one a wide fucking berth. Hope you get what you want for it, I offer. In the meantime, you said you had news about weaving? Up until now, Monty's been closed-lipped about his ideas for the Weaving family. He asked me to give him until Christmas, and Thanksgiving is next week. I'm running out of patience. Monty waggles his eyebrows, rocking back in his chair. It's rare to see him looking this pleased with himself. Caleb Weaving's been running all kinds of shit through his warehouses for years. Anything he can turn a profit on. The Dreadnoughts used to make runs for him sometimes, but Caleb's a fucking snob. He never wanted to deal with Q in person, so he had me act as go-between. Some shit went down last year, and the cops caught wind that Caleb had his hand in a particular pot that he should have been leaving well alone. They pulled him in for questioning. The bastard was squeaky clean, of course. He threw Q and the boys under the bus, though. Said they were smuggling in counterfeit goods through the port in Seattle. Cops raided the Dreadnought shop and found all kinds of stolen Chinese tech. Goods worth well over $3 million to the right buyers. All Caleb's stuff. That motherfucker walked away without a speck of dirt on him, and three of Q's boys ended up with 7 years apiece because of it. This is all news to me. The Weaving family are disgustingly rich, but as far as anyone in Raleigh is concerned, Caleb Weaving built his burgeoning empire off the back of stalks of wheat. Nearly every single farm you drive past in Grays Harbor County is owned by the Weaving family, and the ones that aren't are all paying a premium to grow Weaving's genetically modified seeds. They have no choice in the matter. The farmers who refused to sell to Weaving in the 90s soon found themselves slapped with lawsuits because they were found to be illegally cultivating a crop containing seeds patented by Caleb and his board of cronies. The seeds were either blown onto their land and grew there naturally, mingling in with the pre-existing wheat crops, or Weaving hired somebody to sneak onto their fields at night and plant them there by hand. Either way, the result wound up being the same. The farmers had to either sell to Weaving, pay him a ridiculous annual premium for his seeds, or face ruin, bankruptcy, and even foreclosure at the expert hands of Caleb's legal team. It's hardly surprising that a man who would stoop to those levels would also be dealing in smuggled goods along with God only knows what else. Q's been keeping tabs on that fucker ever since then. He's been compiling a dossier of Weaving's illegal activity, and he's ready to sell the bastard out. Anonymously, of course. If any of our other connections found out the Dreadnoughts were willing to hand over information like that, there'd be serious fucking consequences. No one would do business with them ever again. More likely, one of the other gangs would gun anyone wearing a Dreadnoughts patch down in the street. You know how these things go. Snitches get fucked, even if they were the ones who got fucked first. I crack my thumb knuckles, taking a moment to wrap my head around everything he's telling me. Getting Caleb Weaving sent down would be pretty fucking sweet, Monty. It'd tarnish their family name for life. But my problem isn't with Caleb. It's with his son. Jacob's the one who hurt Silver. He's the one who needs to pay. Monty grins, flashing me a wall of teeth. Patience is a virtue, kid. I'm not done yet. He takes his time pulling open the drawer to his desk. I'm practically squirming in my seat as he takes out a plain manila envelope, sets it down, and slides it across the desk toward me. Take a look. He pulls a smoke out of a pack by his laptop, places the filter between his lips, and lights the end. I think you're gonna like what you see. The envelope's thin. Whatever's inside isn't that substantial. When I open it up and take out the contents, I find a small stack of enlarged photos in my hand. They're dark and a little grainy, but it's still easy to make out what's going on in the images. There's a figure in the center of the frame, and he's holding a woman by the roots of her hair. A young girl, wearing a Raleigh High cheerleader's uniform. Her face is contorted into a mask of pain. Her hands grappling at the figure's wrist, trying to free herself of the guy's vicious grip. I flip through the pictures one at a time, my stomach knotting tighter and tighter as the scene between the two people becomes progressively more violent. The end photo is difficult to look at. There are four people in this image. The girl's on her back, two guys at her head holding her down on the ground by a swimming pool. She's been stripped down to her underwear. The Raleigh Roughnecks shirt now floating on the surface of the pool. Her bra has been pulled down her body, exposing her tits, and the guy who was dragging her by her hair in the first image is positioned between her legs, his pants shoved down around his thighs. It's a horrifying scene. The girl's clearly trying to fight her way free, her hands clenched, her mouth open in a silent scream, tears streaking mascara down her cheeks. The guys forcing her to the ground are all wearing the same frenzied, lurid expressions. I take one look at it, and the gas station burrito I ate on the way over here churns in my stomach, trying to rise up the back of my throat. My imagination has painted a fairly graphic scene of what went down with Silver, and that's been bad enough. This is so much worse. This is what it would have been like for her. This is how scared she would have been. I slide the photos back inside the envelope, unable to look at them anymore. My head's fucking pounding. I clear my throat, trying to ignore the fact that, more than anything, I want to fucking throw up right now. My mouth is sweating like crazy.
Seems as though the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, Monty says delightedly. Young Jake has been helping his father on a number of his runs lately. We have plenty of shots of him attending meetings with his father, handling very large amounts of heroin, and now Q's added this little tell-all to his dossier of evidence. Jake'll go down for his involvement in his father's illegal dealings anyway, but this is the kind of shit you really wanted him to go down for, right? Oh yeah.
Monty is right, because the figure in the photos, the person committing the most heinous crime of all in that final shot, is none other than Jacob Weaving himself. Both Sam and Killian are proven guilty in that picture, too. But with Sam already long dead and rotting in the ground courtesy of Leon Wickman, only Killian can be held accountable, alongside the captain of Raleigh's football team.
Q's planning on handing everything he's collected over to the DEA at the end of the week. I didn't want to say anything until I knew it was definitely happening. Plan was greenlit this morning, though. Figured it was high time I filled you in. Your girl won't need to testify if she can't hack a courtroom. What he did to this girl alone will be enough to convict Jacob of rape. It'll be just one in a long list of charges. I knew seeing that would make you fucking happy. Happy isn't exactly the word I'd use to describe how I'm feeling right now, but he's correct. These photos will be enough to convict Jacob and Killian. Jacob has a penchant for Raleigh High cheerleaders, huh? Monty observes, pulling on his cigarette. You know that one, kid? Yeah. The word comes out hard, stiff, and unhappy. I did recognize the girl Jacob was manhandling the moment I laid eyes on her. Her name is Zen McCready. She's friends with that pretty girlfriend of yours. Used to be. Monty's mouth turns down at the corners as he nods, filing this information away. Since the DEA will be dragging your boy Weaving off in cuffs at the end of the week, that gives you 5 days, man. 5 days to plot and plan and exact revenge however you see fit. What have you got in mind? I stare at the manila envelope, now neatly tucked underneath the edge of Monty's laptop, and, surprised, end up muttering words I never thought I'd hear myself say. Nothing. I'm not gonna do anything. He's gonna be arrested at last. The sick motherfucker's gonna go to jail for a very long time, and he's gonna pay for what he's done. I don't need to do a damn thing. Monty's eyes sharpen, his bushy, thick eyebrows tugging together to meet in the middle. Are you fucking kidding me right now? I shake my head. Silver's all I care about, man. If Jake gets what's coming to him and I don't even need to get involved, then fuck yeah. That's a fucking win. Justice is done and I don't have to risk serious jail time that'll take me away from my girl. Monty laughs softly, shaking his head. He stubs out his smoke and fishes in his pack for another one, barely taking a breath in between. God almighty. I never thought it'd happen to you, kid. You went and got yourself some high-grade pussy and it's made you fucking soft. He can laugh at me all he wants. He's going to mock me over this until the end of time, but I don't fucking care. I'm not gonna act like a dumb, arrogant prick and get my hands dirty just to prove I'm a man, when there's a chance I could lose everything because of it. Monty heaves a sigh when I don't defend myself. A thoughtful look forms on his face. Looking down at the bag on the table, he hums under his breath, then slowly zips the bag back up, pushing it across his desk toward me. You'll change your mind, son, and when you do, I'm sure this'll come in handy. Use whatever tool tickles your imagination. Probably not safe to keep it here anyway. I've laid eyes on it. I know it'll be safe with you. Just don't let anyone else touch it, you hear? Especially not Q, or any of the other dreadnoughts. I'm pushing the bag of torture implements back toward him, shaking my own head, when Monty slumps back into his chair, clenching his jaw. Thanks, kiddo. Sorry for all the to-ing and fro-ing with that thing. You know you're actually doing me a really big favor. And that's it. Just like that, with a few simple words, he's made it impossible for me to say no.
Text message received. 1-564-987-3491. The entire team's gonna get a ride next time. When you gonna let us feed that greedy cunt, Parisi? We're gonna make you fucking bleed. 13. Silver.
Oh my goodness! Silver? This is a surprise.
Mrs. Richmond looks genuinely shocked to see me when she opens up the front door to her house. I'm shocked I'm here too. I would have texted my brother to let him know I was outside, and he could have just come out to meet me. That would have been the easiest way to manage this uncomfortable situation. But Max still hasn't got a cell phone, so I was shit out of luck in that department. When Mom messaged and asked me if I could pick my brother up from the Richmonds, I immediately typed out a message telling her absolutely, categorically, no freaking way. I haven't been over here in a really long time, after all. I used to visit at least once a week with the other girls. We'd rotate between houses, which generally meant the Sirens spent time at each other's places regularly. Since everything went down with Jake, however, I've made sure to avoid even driving down this street at all costs. Mom hasn't asked me for anything since she moved out, though. Not a single request or favor. As a point of principle, she's been trying to show me that she doesn't need to lean on me the way she did during the months leading up to her separation from Dad. And honestly, it's been kind of amazing. I love Max. I never minded the cooking or cleaning or running errands for her, but it also does feel like I just got my life back. Mom's been working as a freelance CPA for the mayor's office, though. Started out as a temporary position, but they spoke with her last week and told her that it could become permanent if she was willing to put the work in. She needs this job to afford the rent on her new place. So when she told me their month-end budget meeting ran long and she couldn't get away today, I made the decision to swallow down my anger at her and show her a little support. Casey's been gone for well over a month. Melody, Halliday, and Zen are still stuck together like glue, but they haven't been on the attack where I've been concerned. So I figured standing on the Richmond's doorstep for 5 seconds while Max got his shoes wouldn't be that big an ordeal. I was wrong, though. It feels so normal being here, like I should just waltz right on and make myself at home. On Thursdays, I used to teach guitar to a kid around the corner from here, and occasionally I'd stop by and pick up Halliday when I was done. We'd go grab a milkshake at the diner or go swimming at Lake Sammish in the summertime. The front door of the house was never locked. I'd let myself in and park myself on a stool by the breakfast counter, grazing on whatever fruit was in the bowl there by the key tray while she got ready for us to leave. So much has changed since then. Being here isn't normal anymore. I'd never dream of letting myself in and making myself at home these days. Mrs. Richmond opens her mouth, then closes it again. She doesn't seem to know what to say. Her hair is longer than I remember, but it looks a little lank, and her roots are showing. She always used to be so well put together, but today, in her sweatpants and her oversized Raleigh High Class of 1990 t-shirt, I barely even recognize her.
"Would you like to come in?"
she asks, blinking rapidly. Her voice is 3 octaves higher than usual, strained.
"The boys are still in the back room. I told Max your mom would be by to get him soon, but they were in the middle of a campaign apparently and didn't want to stop. Shouldn't take them long to get finished up, though."
Fuck. Goddamn boys and their video games. I do not want to step foot inside this house. I definitely don't want to hang around while Max finishes up a campaign on whatever new game he and Jamie have become addicted to. If he knows I've come to collect him instead of Mom, he'll use it to his advantage and take forever to leave. I shift from one foot to the other, glancing back at the Nova over my shoulder. God, how the fuck am I supposed to say no without coming off like a jerk? I should have left the car's engine running or something.
"Sure, Mrs. Richmond. Thank you. That would be lovely."
I'm not sure what reasoning Halliday gave her mom when I stopped coming around here, but from the way Mrs. Richmond keeps looking at me out of the corner of her eye, her daughter didn't paint me in a very good light. Inside, I tow my shoes off and slide them under the mail stand, out of the way, force of habit. Mrs. Richmond loiters in the hallway for a second and then nervously rubs her hands together.
"All right, then. Well, you know your way to the back room, don't you? Why don't you go and light a fire under your brother? I need to check on the oven. I'm making lasagna, and everything seems to be burning recently."
Relieved that she doesn't want to stand around and chat, I let her go without complaint. She hurries off toward the kitchen, her head bowed, feet moving double time, and I head in the opposite direction, toward the conservatory at the rear of the house, known as the back room, where the Richmond children have always been relegated to keep them out of sight. Neither of the boys look away from the television screen when I enter the room. They both know I'm there, though.
"It's not 7 yet, Silver," Max says firmly. "I've got 5 more minutes."
"It's 7 minutes past, actually," I say, looking down at Mickey. "And I have somewhere to be, so you need to get your butt up out of that chair and drag it to the car."
"Hey, Silver."
"Hey, Jamie."
"Don't be nice to her," Max tells his friend. "She's gonna mess up the game."
Jamie's always been sweet. Kind, polite, usually the complete opposite to Max. His hair is even redder than his sister's, more of an orange than auburn, and his face is a constellation of freckles. He's a sensitive kid, the kind that needs a little more affection than your average 11-year-old. I dread what's going to happen to him when he reaches high school. Don't be a butthead, Max. Save the game. You can pick up where you left off next time. My brother hammers at the buttons on the game controller in his hands, and a strafe of gunfire shoots across the TV screen. The loud rattle of sound is unexpected and makes me jump. That's what I tell myself. My heart rate isn't through the roof, and my palms aren't sweating out of nowhere because the sound mentally dragged me, kicking and screaming, back to the halls of Raleigh High, the day Leon killed 18 of my fellow students. Mom doesn't mind waiting for me when she comes. Just chill out, Max snaps. I'll have to wait a whole week to finish otherwise. I'm not stopping just because you want to go hang out with your stupid boyfriend. Whoa. Max has never had an attitude like this with me before. When the fuck did he get so mouthy? I have a lesson to teach. I'm not trying to rush off with Alex. He's working tonight, so you can stow that crap right now. Get your shoes. Get your bag. We're leaving. He ignores me. I am not in the mood for this bullshit. I'm not hanging around the Richmond's place a second longer than I need to either. I can't just pull the plug on the game console like I would at home, though. That wouldn't be fair to Jamie. It's not his fault my little brother is being a little asshole. Poor Jamie slowly lowers his controller, biting his lip anxiously as he looks back at me. It doesn't matter if we have to wait, he tells Max. I won't play without you, I promise. On the screen, a gruesome-looking monster with jagged teeth leaps out, thrashing with horrifying claws. The scene in the game flashes red, the controllers rumbling in the boy's hands. Shoot, 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 Max hollers. It's killing you! Jamie looks torn. He frowns at the game, then hangs his head, choosing not to play. The screen goes bright red, and then a scrawled tag appears in white lettering. The words, "Game over," pulse on the screen, and Max lets out a furious yell. Jesus, Silver! Look what you've done! Why the hell do you have to ruin everything? He jumps to his feet, throwing down his controller. The handset bounces off the chair he was sitting on, the plastic making a cracking sound, the batteries flying out of it. Jamie's mouth falls open, forming a perfectly round O. He doesn't make a sound, despite the fact that my shit of a little brother has probably just broken one of his controllers. Right, that's it. I lunge for Max, grabbing him by the scruff of his neck. You'd better hope that still works or you're gonna be paying for a new one. Move, before I pick you up like a baby and carry you out of here. Max rips himself out of my grasp, spinning on me, his face beet red. God, Silver, you're such a fucking bitch! I've been called the darkest, harshest, cruelest things over the past year by people I thought were my closest friends. None of that hurt as much as this, though. I feel like I've been slapped. Max hurtles past me out of the back room, his footsteps ringing out down the hallway. The front door slams closed a second later, but I can't